Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, and welcome to today's show. My name is Liz, and I am joining you as usual from Central Virginia in the United States on the ancestral lands of the Monacan people, with much gratitude for them, as always, for stewarding this land long before the arrival of my ancestors. So today, we're going to talk about art, and specifically art as a portal of divine connection. The idea of art as a pathway to the divine feminine or the sacred feminine has certainly come up on previous episodes before. And why is that? What is this connection to the sacred feminine? Well, for me, the sacred feminine is an invitation into a different way of being, one that is holistic, that sees the interconnectivity of things, it's intuitive, it's mysterious, it's self-generative, emerging out of our individual experience, but of the whole that we are a part of. And I think of art as offering a similar invitation, one that is also mysterious, it's intuitive, not necessarily informed by linearity in the confines of language. And for me, that impulse to create comes from a place that at times certainly feels divinely inspired. And now's the fun part. We get to see if my guest today, who's an incredible artist, would agree with any of that or would frame it totally differently. Verlina Johnson is a multimedia artist whose work includes drawing, painting, sculpture, puppetry, performance, and video. Much of her artwork is about healing and represents a visual embodiment of love. And she finds inspiration in mysticism, spirituality, feminism, queer theory, and popular culture. Verlina holds two master's degrees, one in Afro-American studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and in sculpture from the Art Institute of Chicago. She has also studied wood carving and has exhibited her work in Chicago, in Oakland, California, Madison, Wisconsin, and New York. She's also the author and illustrator of the children's book, The Adventures of Kai and the Magical Machines, which is inspired by her son. Verlina is joining us today from her home in Los Angeles. Verlina, thank you so much for being here and welcome to the show.
Liz, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very excited about this conversation we're about to have.
Oh, me too. And little backstory here, we've been talking about this for months and just due to some scheduling conflicts, haven't been able to pull it off. So I'm really, really happy that we're here together now.
As am I.
Yeah. So I love to usually start with guests, just hearing a little bit about their spiritual background. So I'd love to just begin there with you and hear from you what religions or any spiritual practices that you were introduced to as a child and how those kind of influenced you growing up.
Sure. I would say growing up, I was born in Chicago, but raised in Madison, Wisconsin in the 70s. And my parents, I would say, weren't particularly religious, although my father was raised a Christian and my mother was actually raised Catholic, but disassociated herself from Catholicism fairly early on and was more bohemian and I would say spiritual, but not particularly in a very structured way while I was growing up. And my father would later, I guess, reclaim his Christian roots, particularly Baptist roots, when I was a little older. And so I definitely grew up when I was a teenager in the Baptist church, and on my own did spend some time in prayer meetings and attending church and was a part of the church choir. But I'd have to say that fairly early on, I realized that the Bible and the sermons did not particularly speak to me, or at least they raised a lot of questions for me. And for me personally, there seemed to be quite a few contradictions. And I hadn't at that time quite knew what those contradictions were, but it just didn't really speak to me on a heart level, I would say. And also some of the scriptures seemed to discount my personal experiences. I came out as a lesbian when I was 17 years old. And I think because of many of the views expressed in the context of church and by using the Bible as it relates to homosexuality, there seemed to be a lot of conflict as it related to who I was as a person and also as a woman, as a young woman who, you know, at that point was reading feminist texts and reading the novels of Toni Morrison and Nikki Giovanni. I would say poetry initially was sort of my entryway into feminist discourse. And so I sought other things, eventually looking first, I would say, at Native American spirituality. There were several authors in particular that I would read and things that were earth-based and probably termed sort of pagan in terms of their context, and really began to explore those types of things. A book, Conversations with God, by Donald Neil Walsh. His books 1, 2, and 3 were particularly informative. And while rooted in Christianity, I felt like they posed so many questions and seemed more akin to what made sense to me, both intellectually and in terms of emotionally and spiritually. So for me, spirituality has been one of a constant search or quest for things that spoke to me individually. And I did not feel bound by a particular dogma, by a particular culture. I later explored and continue to explore Buddhism as expressed in a number of different texts and find that if something speaks to me, then I embrace it. And if it does not, I set it aside, because for me, a spiritual journey is a very individual, and it's intended to be that way. I've never been one to want to be told what to think or how to think, but rather, you know, look towards, you know, different things. And in some ways, I feel as a multiracial person, one, my mother is European American and Native American, and my father's African American. I've never felt very comfortable being placed in a box from that perspective. So very early on, I straddled, I would say, both cultures or outside of both or embracing various things. And that to me seems to be sort of a structure or non-structure that works well, this fluidity. And being able to move between things. So hopefully that answers your question a little bit.
Yes, it definitely does. I'm just kind of chuckling in my head that it seems like kind of lately I've had a few, you know, listeners to the show know that I was raised Baptist. So it's like us Baptists or ex-Baptists are finding each other or something.
Yes.
I've had somebody else recently on the show who was raised as a Baptist too. It's just really interesting. But, you know, I was thinking as you're reflecting, and I'll just share this and see if it moves anything for you. But and also in thinking about having these conversations with other guests before, especially those that were raised in the Christian church, there was almost like, this was my experience, and so I'm curious if this resonates for you. Like as a child, there was almost like there was religion, which was chosen by my family, which was supposed to answer the questions or give me some guidance, and it didn't. And then there was on the other side, this part of me that had so much more depth, I think, or just longing for meaning and connection. But religion was supposed to satisfy it, and it did not. And so there was this kind of profound disconnect, or almost I'm thinking of myself as wondering if that was it just me? You know, was I supposed to be finding it there? And I wasn't, or was that even the purpose of religion? So I don't know. I was just thinking about the separation of wanting these deeply what I would now call spiritual experiences, and not recognizing that opportunity to find them in the kind of box, as you put it, of religion. I don't know how that lands with you.
Yeah, no, that actually really resonates with me. And as you were speaking, I was just thinking about how, for me, when you think about it, And as you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, and I'm not saying any particular thing. This is my interpretation of how I understand Christianity and how it's been presented to me, is that, you know, we speak of very finite, very specific things. God is, you know, a male entity. God exists in heaven. There is a place called hell, you know, these very finite things. And for me, what I've learned through the years is God is infinite. And God is everything, including me. And Goddess resides in me. And God, of course, doesn't have a gender. God could be universe, could be one's higher power, whichever word resonates with you. God extends and goes beyond any particular word or language even. And so I think part of the thing is that we've kind of, in my opinion, just historically, in large contexts, have reduced God and really tried to create a God that is reflective of who we are, and our limitations of ourselves have been so limited. So that, you know, this whole notion of God being a parental sort of figure, and God being angry with us, God having an opinion, well, we can't be given free choice, if you will, and then also have really strict, rigid expectations in terms of how we are to behave. And so I think those are some of the contradictions that I saw very early on in terms of, you know, biblical scriptures, were things of that nature. And so I do feel, from my experience, you know, there are universal truths that exist in many spiritually inspired texts throughout various cultures, and that there's a truth that exists. And I think for me, I feel like it's been my task, if you will, to find which of those truths speaks most directly to my heart and my larger sense of knowing of things. And so, you know, I use the word God, but also goddess, because, you know, going back to the divine and what is sacred, because that's been hugely important. And I feel that at various, you know, moments within various historical or cultural contexts, different people have acknowledge the existence of the divine feminine in very significant ways. And it's because of patriarchy and because of these notions of subservience and hierarchies related to persons based on their genitalia, which I find so ludicrous. It's just, you know, too much. Sometimes we've made everything so male, and we've accepted, you know, that to be real, when in actuality, goddess doesn't have a gender. So even to say goddess, you know, is perhaps not as accurate, but I prefer it because that speaks to me. But I also interchange, and we'll say universe, energies that moves through all things, could be Gaia, Mother Earth. It could be a great many things, but because I feel we're all divine, we are all an extension or part of God as he or she understands themselves, then it's, you know, fair to use either gender, both genders, or pronoun that might be they, them, you know, kind of using language of today to explain that. But, you know, I'm most interested in not finding God outside of myself, as many have done, and building a relationship from there, but building a relationship with myself, recognizing that I am God. You know, God is within each and every one of us, and including animals, the plant and animal kingdom. We are so hierarchical and so binary in our thinking that we feel we humans are, you know, far more important than animals and plants. And I don't believe that to be true.
I'm so glad you said that. I feel that too. And I lots of things were coming up as you were speaking. So I'm going to see if I can kind of bookmark some of them in my head, and maybe we'll come back. But one thing that is present for me is the sacred feminine, and that's the language that I use here, was my introduction to that idea of all life being sacred. The concept of immanence, for example, like that the divine is in everything, as opposed to just being transcendent, you know, sitting up on a cloud somewhere, which is what I got as a child. But the idea that the divine is present in all things was a concept that was introduced to me by my interest in studies in the sacred feminine. However, I think it's really important to acknowledge too, and I think this is kind of going back to what you're saying, is God is in all things, and many traditions can take us there. There's a lot of indigenous wisdom that already embodied that, that knowing that the divine is in all things. So for me, the opening to that wisdom and understanding that God, goddess is a much bigger concept was the sacred feminine. But I think, and this has been an evolution for me, is understanding that she or that God is not locked into a female form. Like she has been the pathway for me to understand, ironically, that she is much bigger than she, if that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I think you're speaking to that I just find really refreshing is this idea of fluidity, which again, I don't know if it's ironic or not, but it was the sacred feminine that introduced me to the notion of fluidity, God, obviously, God is male, female, but just the fluid nature of reality and how any energy moves and flows. And anytime we're trying to box it up and define it too much, we are playing with our limited human faculties, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're not speaking the language of divinity. That's my opinion.
Yes, I absolutely 100% agree. And that's why for me, an example of that, this notion of confining the energy would be when I am producing my work and why I feel it's my life's purpose. I feel as though, and we may speak about this a little later, but it's coming to my mind now, but also that it's very transcendent for me, is that time ceases to exist. I can, and I'll, I can be at my, say, drafting table working on a painting, and I'm thinking in terms of energy, and I've learned to do this, I would say, in the last 5 to 7 years. And I, taken some Reiki classes, actually, and I do feel very connected to a number of crystals and other stones and objects, but I'm channeling energies through my body and through my hands. So I am really in a very different place than I am when I'm thinking analytically about things, right? Because for me, overthinking, for me, intellectualizing things, it has been important primarily as a way to understand the world around me. So I'm not, completely throwing it out and saying it's horrible, but I am saying that I've allowed myself to occupy too much of my time in that realm or in that space or in that way of being. But what art has done as a vehicle is it has allowed me to ground myself in such a way that I can channel sort of these higher ways of knowing or being or existing in space. And the way that I know that I've arrived or I've gotten there, so it's a form of meditation, is that time doesn't exist. I get really present, and I'm not thinking quite in that way. Do I discern different things about the composition, about the subject, about the colors? Of course I do. So I am, as a person, my ego, all that I know about making art is present, but it's really, to me, secondary to the other things. There's an unfolding that happens when I am painting very often. We can talk about that a little more, but it's been really exciting for me as an artist to feel as though I have been listening to the ancestors, I have been listening to my higher knowing, and I have been saying yes, so that as I'm producing the images and the content of my work, that I'm tapped into that source.
And is that, I'm so interested in this, is that something that, maybe you could talk to us a little bit about your journey with art. And is this, was this, I guess it's sort of a question kind of going back to origins as well, as, how is it something that's been present in your life all along, or, is it innate, something, obviously you've developed it, you've got 2 master's degrees. So I know that you've done extensive work in that minefield, but is it, what is your relationship to art and how did that kind of begin to blossom in your life?
Mm-hmm. For me, I have very early memories of making things, even in elementary school. And then I would say by high school, I was an art editor of the school paper and did a lot of comics and drawings. And I, you know, did self-portraits, even back then, a lot of self-portraits and things using clay. I love building things with my hands. My mother's has always been very creative. She, you know, has always cooked. She's, you know, gardened, created beautiful things. And my father is a blues musician, or was a blues musician rather. And so for me, I was, you know, around art, and it's just something I did. But what I realized is that as I was producing work in high school, I found great meaning in it for me personally. And for me, what I've learned to understand is that art has been a very healing site for me. And I literally feel in many ways it helped me to survive some very difficult and challenging situations for my childhood. And so I began to even journal at a fairly early age and write out the things, you know, that I was thinking and that I was feeling. It seemed very safe for me to explore different things. And I used poetry as well. And I feel, you know, when I was thinking in terms of at college, what I would study, I wanted to study art. And so I chose sculpture. And that came to me in a class called Reconstructing Boundaries with Frida Hytesvigorgas, who is a phenomenal artist and art historian in her own right at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I was producing these sculptures called Warrior Women, a series of spiritual, I call them sort of spiritual warriors because I'm a pacifist, but they were embellished, you know, they had everything from pistachio nuts and beads and fabric and broken glass and paint and wood and one, you know, had copper and all of these other materials. And I thoroughly enjoyed making it. And it was she who actually posed the question to me. And I think often things come to us in questions, you know, have you considered more formally studying sculpture? And at that time I hadn't really, I did more painting and drawing, I would say. But I, you know, then decided to focus more on sculpture because I was interested in how things were and in space. And there's something just in terms of processing. And that's kind of what led me to puppetry, was some of these wooden pieces had joints and couldn't they had the appearance that they could articulate, because I was interested in things like empowerment and power and movement and all these conceptual, these ideas, but I would express them through visually and in terms of what I was doing. So I eventually, you know, started doing puppetry, but it started out really with these abstract figurative dolls that I called them, and really thinking in terms of the hierarchy that exists within fine, quote, fine art and quote, fine art versus craft. So I began to explore that, which is why I really embraced woodworking and loved to carve. And I worked with Ghanaian master wood carver, Jam was his name, Vive, and, you know, really thought about culture. I know I'm all over the place, but there were just so many things and so many entryways into ways of knowing that I found very important in art as it related to expressing myself and various ideas related to myself and my narrative, but also in relationship to other people. And while I simultaneously was studying art, I became very interested in African American studies. And would eventually get one of my master's degrees in African American studies, because again, I did not believe, nor did it serve me to think, oh, I'm just a visual artist and I'll produce objects. I wanted to explore and think about object making and the history of objects in various contexts, specifically within African American lives. And so that is exactly what I did. And for my master's, I did a master's thesis on Faith Ringgold, but I also had a solo exhibition at the time of the Warrior Women series, because I do consider myself both a visual artist and an art historian. And I think that was very important for me. But various traditions have very much informed my work, you know, from very different places, I guess, in the world or the globe. I've never felt confined to look simply at so-called master canon of, you know, sort of European male artists, you know. Right. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. And I think that's, I mean, it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned Faith Ringgold, and maybe you can talk about her a little bit more. I had a guest on earlier this year who wrote a, they host a podcast called Missing Witches, which is a wonderful podcast. And they wrote a book too, just profiling women that they thought were, you know, interesting and probably qualified as being spiritual, magical women, you know, so reclaiming that word witches, and they included Faith Ringgold in that. And, but one of the things that you are talking about, which I think is interesting, and you said you were, I don't think you're all over the place. I feel like we're weaving something lovely here together, but,
wonderful.
But you know, I do, I really do, because I'm thin. And let's see if this is one of my challenges. Sometimes I see things in my head that where it all connects. Let's see if I can get it out of my mouth. But, you know, we were talking earlier about, Christianity in particular, and this way in which it gives us kind of this uniform look at the world. And I have wondered that, and I'm curious about that for you in terms of fine art. You said fine art versus craft. Well, if we're talking about craft, we're oftentimes talking about women's work and Indigenous people's work, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And whereas fine art is really typically made by men of European descent. And so right there, you've got, it's a colonizer's lens, which, you know, you could say is very similar to the conversation we're having about religion as well. Like there's one way to view it and it goes through this lens and only that qualifies. So I don't, yeah, let you respond to that, I guess.
I mean, it's absolutely true. As I was doing the literature review for my thesis, and I chose Faith Ringgold, I think for a number of reasons, but one was, you know, her work. And I was just interested specifically in her uses of image and text. So I think it's kind of uncanny that I would write a children's book, and I have a couple of others that I'd like to write. But, you know, she did soft sculptures, you know, in the 70s, and many of them were very sort of had such an incredible analysis about women and women's work, women in relationship to culture and hierarchies and things of that nature. So always in her work, there's a self-reflective component, which is very common, honestly, in women's work. And she started doing, and her mother was a seamstress, and she started doing these story quilts. And so she would look at modernism and postmodernism and sort of critique it, and primitivism and its relationship to African art, and how, you know, the modernists and people like Pablo Picasso were looking towards Africa for their inspiration, you know, these primitive peoples, these very simple peoples. And there was all of this language not only embedded sort of in within her work, but when I looked at the art historical texts that were talking about her work and the way it was like, quote, child, like, you know, these diminutive ways in which they talked about her little work and, you know, its fabric and so forth. And I was just so blown away by that. And honestly, I felt it was part of my task to reframe her work, you know, thinking about it in a much more complex way and thinking about it in a very different way. And so for me, in terms of how that has influenced my work, really, I feel like women before us, it gives me permission to do and be whatever I want to do and be, and to work in whatever materials so strike me, you know, when, you know, various modern contemporary artists have used different materials, you know, in particular ways, they're considered geniuses. Oh, the urinal piece, that's so incredible, you know, on and on and on, you know. But I think when you have like David Hammons or other artists using, quote, found objects and repurposing things and making it, it's has been seen historically in very different ways. You even think in terms of outsider art and self-taught artists. I mean, there's so many divisions and hierarchies that exist in the art world. And so for me, I've never felt restricted. I mean, I work a lot now in watercolors because it really, really speaks to me as a process and just materially speaking. But one of the pieces that I made earlier this year, maybe it was late last year, was a puppet that I made out of papier-mâché. And I love carving marionettes, but I also have used paper mache. And what I had at my disposal was newspaper, and I used wallpaper paste. And I, you know, made to me this extraordinary puppet from material that one could find at a hardware store, at a grocery store. You know what I'm saying? And so to me, there's an accessibility about using these materials to create and make things. And so if I feel I want to use pistachio shells, which I've done, I've painted and adorned things with those things. But when you think about when I have, you know, thought about African art, which I'm most probably familiar with, and I look at the embellishments that are happening, the raffia, you know, the various natural material, you think of fiber arts and so forth, there's such a richness. And it goes back also to using things that are either found, to repurpose them, you know, to kind of refigure them. All of those things are very, I would say, like you were saying, in terms of the either divine feminine, or amongst women's cultural production, like quilting, or indigenous peoples, you know, people for whom there aren't these hierarchies. So, you know, I often feel like I'm in both sort of the more traditional, conventional Western art making practice, but also in a great many others. And so I don't feel confined by, nor do I feel I need permission to produce, or does anyone for that matter, to produce the work that we're compelled to produce. And that for me was such a liberating, after I graduated from the Arts Institute of Chicago in 2001, one of the things that I felt I did for about a year or two is I had to unlearn kind of what I had learned. I loved my experience there. I worked with some incredible, amazing artists and thinkers and creative folk. But I also felt like making art isn't something that can be taught. It's something you learn through experience, you know. So you can teach technique, yes, but what my path is and how I produce and what I produce, that's a very, very, like religion, it's a very personal sort of a series of decisions that I've made. Yeah. Mm.
I'm so glad you used the word permission too, because that was coming up in my head. I know a lot of people, I think, and I can say that I had called myself, you know, as someone who's not creative. And I think there's a way in which we can look at art and tell ourselves that if we're not some sort of expert, and again, just like all that you've just said, we really have to question who's mm-hmm. making those decisions, what their lens is, like why we are having shared agreement around this. But that if we're not experts at it, then we don't have permission to do it, because, mm-hmm. you know, we're not exceptional or we're not gifted. And so I think liberating ourselves from that, well, just recognizing that it's a false narrative that we don't have to accept is really powerful. And then figuring out ways to liberate ourselves is so important. So I think even just hearing you talk about it is helpful, you know, to step back and say, it's personal and it's our relationship with the world. I don't know. Would you say it's our relationship with the divine as well?
Absolutely. Everything for me has gone back to that. I mean, from the moment, even prior to my incarnation into this body, into this life and this set of experiences, you know, I'm making choices, but I feel that God, creator, has communicated and has been communicating through me as me my entire life. And for me, when I quiet my mind and when I'm present with what is being communicated, there have been themes that have existed always. So this work of the self as divine, as an example, is something I've been doing now for 20, 25 years at least. And as I look back at my body of work, that it exists, and there's an impulse, there is a desire, there is a need for me to explore that. And so part of what I've done, you know, through introspection and just meditation is thinking about why is that, you know. And I think when we listen to ourselves, ultimately, we know why that is oftentimes. And I feel like things will come up, or I have found in my life, things have come up over and over again, in part until I have said yes, and until I have showed up in a very particular way for myself. Because I think it is about liberating the mind from and unlearning all of the things, all of the messages that I have continually been given about who I am and what I am and what I should be is malarkey. It's absolute utter nonsense, really. And, you know, I continue to work on that. So the unlearning the things that I've learned. And I think there's such tremendous freedom in that. And so when I'm doing my work, to me, that is about liberation, you know, and people like bell hooks and, you know, many others have talked about, you know, the personal being political, you know, and I think for me, one of, there are two very inspiring other artists, you know, which would be not only Faith Ringgold, but Frida Kahlo, and also Audre Lorde. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of being able to present ourselves as both being very vulnerable in terms of our vulnerabilities and our humanness, but also incredibly powerful beyond measure. And when, for me, when I can balance that, those realities, if you will, in the context of my being, there's such peace that I experience on a daily basis versus feeling, oh, that I'm weak, that I'm, you know, that I'm too vulnerable, that I'm incapable of whatever, you know, facing life, if you will, versus, you know, that I am very powerful and I'm a creator and I manifest my realities, you know, as I desire them. But part of that and what my art has done, and I'll tell you a little story to sort of demonstrate this, I think, is that, you know, going back to how personal my art has been, there was a period where I took a small sketchbook of plain paper, and I loved the texture of the paper, and it was an off-white paper, and it was a soft, probably about 20 page sort of journal, and I filled it with little drawings. I say little just in terms of their size, and a lot of them were self-portraits, drawing of my son, what he, in terms of what he might look like when he got older, you know, me birthing myself, so kind of using Frida Kahlo's, one of her images of her birthing herself, and I used gel pens and some watercolor, and then the various texts, and I talked about Reverend Michael Beckwith, and who is the founder and spiritual teacher at Agape Spiritual Center, and just a number of things that were influencing me at the time. And I filled this book with my thoughts and feelings. And then I was drinking tea as I'm drinking now, and I spilled a little bit of my tea or a lot of my tea on this book. It just happened in an accident. In an instant, I felt such utter, oh my goodness. I was so beside myself. But that experience of regret or whatnot lasted for about 15 or 20 seconds. And then a voice, my inner voice said, you know, Verlina, one, you need to work larger, both, I think, in terms of concept, I took that, but also in terms of size, and you need to share your work. Because one of the things that I've done is I've always worked and done work and been inspired. And I have shared my work some, but at that time I hadn't really sought as many opportunities to share as I have more recently, within probably the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. And so for me, I took that as a signal or a communication for myself. And then I began to get larger pieces of watercolor paper. And so now some of my pieces are quite large, and I still want to work larger still. And I think because I feel my work is inspired, and because I feel like we are all connected in our experiences, you know, some of them are very similar, it seems to us, and others are quite different. But I thoroughly enjoy, you know, having opportunities to speak with others about what they're doing. And I found tremendous inspiration in what others are producing, what others are talking about. And I feel in part that is part of my life's purpose, is to be myself as transparently as I can, and to share about my journey, frankly. And part of the way that I do that personally is through my work. And if I'm not sharing my work, then I'm not doing what my life's purpose is, in part. I'm not to hoard it, but rather to share it, to inspire others. And that is part of my healing process also. And since so much of my work literally is about, has been about my healing and reclaiming my voice and who I am and how I am and to, how I'm to be and to create that, I feel like that, you know, our actions speak volumes about our beliefs. You know, we manifest, we act out our thoughts and feelings about things through what it is that we do. And for me, the art is that platform, it's a tool, it's a site for exploration. And there was a period where I thought so much about the symbolism in my work that my use of crows and blackbirds and butterflies as symbols of transformation and magic and communicators between this realm and the spirit realm, et cetera, that I did not think in terms of the energy that I physically put into my work, into the paint, into the, whether it's stretched canvas or into the paper. But I really truly do feel that, like mandalas or like other things, that objects also have tremendous energy. And so when we imbue or convey or transfer that energy into those objects then they do have a life. So if you think of it in those terms, you know, art functions or operates on more than just one sort of level in terms of consciousness, but it also, it's vibrating, you know? And so that for me was a very insightful eureka moment, if you will, when I really thought in those terms. And so I very intentionally and very deliberately think about that. And I often am smudging my work, you know, as I'm working on it. I often surround my work with crystals and other things, and sometimes listen to Tibetan singing bowl music or other things that are really just creating this environment, you know, that is conducive for healing, but also for sharing that with others. I wish to inspire, you know, others to heal themselves, however they perceive it in terms of their journey. If it inspires someone, I feel like my work has been successful in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I wanted to ask you about the, you know, working with crystals and Reiki and, you know, how you include that in your process. But is that something that has kind of evolved over time through experimentation, or you brought these things into your process intuitively, or how has that kind of evolved for you?
Predominantly intuitively. I have even early memories, you know, in my, maybe my teenage or my early 20s, feeling as though, you know, I had the ability to move energy through my hands, even before I knew what Reiki was, to heal. And I remember once my mother had injured her or twisted her knee, and I recall, you know, placing my hands on her knee. Now, I have no idea, honestly, how I knew to do that, but I felt compelled to do it. And she said, oh, you know, Verlina, my knee does feel better. And as she was walking, she exclaimed that to me. She explained that to me. And I remember feeling as though my knee now is hurting a little bit. And so as I began to read and sort of understand how that works, I felt like I had absorbed or taken in sort of her pain or what she was experiencing, rather than moving the energy through me. So I feel like we all, each and every one of us, of course, have the capacity to heal ourselves and others and animals and, you know, and whatnot, and to really also channel the energies of the earth, you know, the energy of the earth. Oh my gosh, so powerful and so restorative in so many respects. And so I have done some reading. And then when I took the Reiki courses, I'm at level two, I began to understand, I guess, more intellectually what was happening or how it worked. And I think it's through that that I realized that, again, you know, we needn't limit sort of that energies to sort of doing these like treatment sessions, if you will, mm-hmm. that we can walk through our lives always, you know, with this mindset of healing ourselves and others. So we literally could see someone in distress, say a passerby, you know, someone we pass by in the street, and then see them in distress, and we could just send them good intentions or love. Love to me is where it's at. That is the key to everything, you know? And so it really is the energy that heals, that binds us all together. And it is literally more than that, is who we are fundamentally at our very core. And so, you know, I began to really ask myself, what would love do in this situation? Like, what would love's response be? You know, and that as a guiding principle has really helped me to make better decisions. And so And, you know, and in conversations also, you know, I've refined sort of my thinking about that and my understanding of that. But I feel like our ancestors, and I feel like all of those who have gone before us knew the power of plant medicine as an example, and have utilized that to heal ourselves and one another. And there are shamans and there are others, you know, many people, many different types of modalities exist. And I think really, you know, healing through art has been my personal journey, and it is how I define myself in the world and what I wish to focus on most. But I'm thinking about these principles always. I mean, even at my job, you know, people understand me as being somebody of a particular type, like a calm person, someone who brings a certain kind of energy to every situation. And so that's where, you know, when we compartmentalize and we think, oh, we only need to pray or be a particular way on a Sunday or in particular context, that it becomes very problematic. When you understand that is who you are fundamentally, and in all of our relationships, my most recent painting is called Divine Love, and it's about my relationship with my partner. And so I think in terms of all of these principles as it relates to our relationship and relationships with others as well, not just this particular romantic or intimate relationship, but all my relationships with my son as well. You know, I belong to him and he belongs to me, and simultaneously we don't belong to either one of us. But we have decided to share in this experience as mother and son, and it has been truly an expansive and liberatory experience. And again, giving me more opportunities to both heal and also to manifest or to create.
Yeah, I love that. I love that question. You know, what would love do in this situation? So earlier you were talking about certain symbols that you've worked with or that you've painted. You mentioned crows and butterflies, these symbols of transformation. And I'm curious if those are still showing up for you artistically, or if there's other symbols that are particularly calling to you in your current work.
Yeah, so spirals have also been another symbol. I would say that in terms of my body of work over the last 25 years, spirals show up often, and spirals has to do with the continuity and infinity, and the only constant is change, and sort of really kind of embracing those ideas. You know, I have a spiral tattoo on the nape of my neck, and I think for me to think in terms of fluidity and whatnot is hugely important. And the spiral really exists in many different contexts, both naturally, you know, and in terms of sort of has had historical cultural meaning to different peoples across the globe. So that for me has been a symbol. Also, language is hugely important, and I, in my more, well, actually, in quite a bit of my work, will use text. I've been using a lot of iridescent paint, watercolor paint, and have been exploring sort of reflective qualities of the paint and how, depending upon how the light hits the iridescent paint, how the words sort of present themselves more boldly or in a more subdued way. And so the experience then becomes of one of constant change. So I've been kind of experimenting with those things. But the animals, you know, birds in particular really do speak to me, and I continue to use those. Flowers oftentimes and the divine love, their birds of paradise being presented. There are moons, the crescent moon in particular, the sun, you know, things from the cosmos. Oftentimes in my paintings, there will be stars as well, because I believe we are made from the stars, for one. And there's something so transcendent and so awe-inspiring about looking into the night sky and seeing these magnificent stars above. It lets us know that there's something far beyond us. And, you know, and at the same token, just this acknowledgement that that's who we are, who and what we are, that really ultimately we are all connected. And then the other symbol I feel that exists in my work very frequently are halos. So halos, of course, have, in the ironically, sort of in a Christian sense, have
Yeah.
the you know, this historical significance, you know, related to usually it's Jesus and sometimes Mary or other apostles and things of that nature. But Ethiopian art also has utilized the halo. For me, I love the fact that it's a circle of light, really, and that it just to me symbolizes divinity, period, plain, simple, like that. And so I've placed halos behind my head, because again, we're all divine, and that of my son or mother or many people that I've depicted. Even animals and flowers have received halos, as I too believe they're divine. So, you know, symbols, of course, are just a language that is imbued with lots of meaning and is a kind of quick reference point to communicate those things. So there's a series, an LGBT African-American historical series that I did, in which Baird Rustin and Audre Lorde and, you know, a number of literary figures, political figures, singers, et cetera, have been depicted with halos. And for me, you know, when I think of the lives of these individual people, which have been a extraordinary in terms of what they've produced, in terms of their art, their craft, their political, you know, their intellectual contributions, but also to think in terms of how they've been discussed in their lifetimes and after, and how they've been omitted from, you know, different historical canons, I really wanted to elevate them, not only in terms of spiritually saying that this individual is divine, say Audre Lorde as an example, but also to reclaim her place in the literary canon, because a great many of us know who she is or know of her. And then there are hordes of people who have no clue or idea to her body of work and to her contributions and to she was just an absolutely extraordinary human being and writer. And so for me, creating the series of these individuals elevates them kind of two or threefold, and then also, you know, connects us all really, truly, because there are so many remarkable people, even people, of course, who haven't produced or been even received that level of notoriety, I feel. But that's also a really important project to me, and one that I will continue to develop and share, you know, more publicly in a number of different ways.
Yeah, I love that. I also, the word reclaiming was coming to mind too, of thinking of that, the halo, the symbol of divinity, and taking that out of just solely the Christian context and placing it, you know, like reclaiming that symbol as belonging to so many more, well, really to all of us, you know, as you've just mm-hmm. named. That feels really powerful. Yeah. I was also curious, and I think you mentioned this briefly, but I wonder if maybe if we could expand on it a little bit, as I was thinking about, you know, if or and how you might feel like your ancestors are speaking to you or working through you or collaborating with you on your art. Do you feel that in any way? And how does that show up if so?
I absolutely do. I feel such incredible gratitude for everyone. And when I use the word ancestor, for me, it both means the people who are more directly related to me. My parents now who have passed over, who, you know, transitioned, my grandparents, aunts and uncles, you know, relatives that are blood related to me, but also more broadly, because again, since we're all connected, I feel that there are forces, spirits or ancestors, if you will, that really do want us to, you know, get our shit together, who really are rooting for us. Fundamental, like just really want us to be healed and to be whole and to feel good about who and what we are. And, you know, I feel most connected, for example, to my mother, who transitioned in 2016, and feel her encouragement. And whether it is based on the things that she taught me prior to her transitioning, or ways in which I feel like she communicates to me still. I told my mother while she was dying. She had received her cancer diagnosis in February, and by July she had transitioned. And I visit her probably 4 or 5 times. She lived in Wisconsin. And I said, "Mommy, come to me in feathers. You know, after you've passed, come to me in feathers." You know, and at that time she was still alert, and she kind of nodded sheepishly and you know, kind of agreed to that. And so we had an understanding. My mother had a tattoo of a feather on her hand. I had given her a feather stained glass and placed it in the room where she transitioned, actually. And because of my affinity to birds and my understanding, you know, to cardinals and what the cardinal represents, you know, those who have passed and gone on before us often appear to those, you know, to communicate that they're okay. And I put some bird feeders outside of her window. And as she was lying in her hospital bed, she could look out and see the birds. And while she spoke, she would speak about those squirrels taking the bird seed. And, you know, she was like shaking her fist at that. And then when she could no longer speak, I would describe for her the birds and the sky and the things that were happening there. But I feel as though when I see a feather, and it's not just seeing feathers, one can see feathers all the time, but there are particular thoughts I'm having, or, you know, ways that I'm feeling, and I my path crosses a feather, that it has some significance. And I feel that's my mother, you know, sort of communicating to me and letting me know that she's nearby always, she's with me. And so I feel deeply that, you know, there's the here, the physical, and then there's the spirit realm, and that there is not a separation or division because of my limited sort of perhaps way of seeing, right? Because I am here in this realm predominantly, but that we can receive communications from people who have passed on before us if we allow ourselves to do that, and if we're open to that. You know, and I never want to have people feel as though I'm saying, in essence, you're not hearing your deceased so-and-so speak to you because you're closed, or it's your fault, or anything even remotely like that. I just feel like there are possibilities of those types of communications. But one of the things that I think has been important for me to be present with that is to set aside my expectation that my mother is a, quote, ghost, and she will like move an object and elevate it off a table, and that will be what I will experience. To me, it's far more subtle than that. And for me, you know, it has more, there are more possibilities if I'm incredibly open and quiet, mm-hmm. you know? And so for me, I've asked questions of my mother and others and of the ancestors, and I've used a pen, and this too came to me intuitively, and I would ask questions, and then I would begin to write down the things I felt my mother was communicating to me. And I was like, "Oh, Verlina, that's just you having thoughts, you're missing your mom." And what was so incredible to me about that experience is that the voice was hers, and she would say things to me, like the first time I did it or the second time I was chewing gum and popping it, cracking it. And my mother hated when I did that. And she said, "Okay, Verlina, this is what you need to, first of all, you need to stop cracking your gum because it's annoying." And I kind of laughed, and I felt her laughter. And then she said, "Ground, put your feet physically on the ground, both of them now, and stand up straight. And imagine, you know, this light coming from through your seventh chakra. And you want to really ground yourself and be very open. And when we're having these conversations or these dialogues." And so I, for me, you know, I took that as being very meaningful, because the instruction to me was not something that I was thinking. When you're with your thoughts, you know that you're thinking them. You're in the driver's seat, so to speak, and you're making the decisions, and the voice is clearly your own. But she was able to distinguish and come through to me in her personality. And so I could distinguish between my own thinking and her sort of entering, and because of my openness. Now, there will be some who are listening who may not believe in that, but it has, again, importance for me. And I think that's the important thing about all of what I'm saying, is that we, for me, it's been just critically important for me to give permission to myself to move through the world in a way that makes sense for me. No explanation is necessary for anyone, because this life, the lives that we were gifted, are our lives to live. And so we create meaning, and we, you know, decide what is important and what is not important. Hopefully in our lifetimes, we can discern that and live the lives that we are intended to live as we define it. And so for me, part of acknowledging ancestors in the presence of people who have moved before me, whether they're, you know, related to me by blood or not, has been hugely important. You know, if I, you know, because I do feel that because we transcend our bodies and we're talking of energies and consciousness, to then suggest that we are limited and we're incapable of interacting with others who are not either in this realm or in this physical existence, to me would seem contradictive. You know, for me personally, that would not make sense. And so I feel there's a very rich set of experiences I can have by being extraordinarily broad and open, you know, to those possibilities and engaging even the nature to me similarly, very similarly, nature, trees. If one has any question as to whether Mother Earth, okay, and I'll just again use the divine feminine, Mother Earth has such energy, go hug a tree ASAP. If you have not done it, do it ASAP. If you choose to do it, you know, yes. And because what I experience is such joy and beauty in that experience. And I literally can feel every hug in my heart chakra. No doubt that would be my experience because Mother Earth hugs back and one can feel connected to the wind, you know, to the rain, to the sun, to the trees, to the earth. If you are feeling discombobulated and ungrounded, take off your shoes if you can. Find a spell of grass or ground and place your feet in that and connect, feel the connection and being held and embraced in such a beautiful way. And so, you know, I think that we spend so much time, and this is very Western and it's very male often, I believe, but in thinking of reality in very limited ways and not counting on our intuition as an example, or our gut is another way to say that. But when we are open and in touch with ourselves and our gut and our hearts, we have these experiences and we feel moved by them. And there's a reason that you feel stirred, you know, by planting your feet in the ground or hugging a tree or, you know, speaking aloud perhaps to a grandparent who has transitioned. And we just feel this comfort and this sense of like longing, perhaps, you know, somewhat fed just a little bit because we feel closeness because they're right there. And I feel that they, the spirit world, desires for us to reach out and to request, you know, their presence, you know. So when we dismiss, oh, I couldn't have possibly felt or known this particular thing, we're shutting out opportunities of knowing, I feel, that are just literally at our fingertips.
Oh yeah. I'd say, yes. I feel so much everything that you've said. And in a lot of ways, I feel like it just weaves back to what we've, you know, it's been coming up as a theme. This whole conversation is this, you know, whether or not we call it this Western lens or whatever, that tells us there's kind of one way of being and seeing the world. And that's just not the case. there's many ways that we can view and experience the world. For me, my path into that was learning about the sacred feminine, you know, but mm-hmm. I mean, again, I would just go back to, there's many indigenous traditions around the world who would say, well, of course, this is the way this is, you know, right? Yeah. Like this, we wouldn't even question that you could speak to your ancestors in this way, or that the wind could speak to you, or that Mother Earth can move her energy through you just by taking your shoes off. It's commonplace elsewhere. So I think knowing that is so refreshing. And I wanted to mention, because I recently learned this, there's the mental part of me, you know, that aspect of my mind that really likes to be fed facts and history. And I think in some ways is particularly starved for it with my European ancestry, because, you know, that whatever indigenous wisdom that Europeans held got so largely erased by Christianity. But I was recently reading that there was a practice in that continued up through the early Middle Ages where it was called sitting out. And that is what that's what the witches, you know, who were the wise mm-hmm. women, that's what they did. They went and they sat on the land and they listened, and that's it.
Absolutely. That's right.
Yeah. And so, yeah. And maybe they were hugging trees too. They probably were, because it feels good.
It really does.
But we can get so much wisdom, you know, just from simply sitting and being. And yeah. Yeah. So I feel all that, all of it. And I guess, you know, I'm feeling like maybe, and maybe this will be a final question or sort of heading us in this direction, is I'd love to know, well, so what's present for you now? What are you working on now? You mentioned your African-American LGBT series. What, you know, where's your art and where's the divine taking you these days? And how can we learn more about it too? So I'll definitely want to include that.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to include the where to learn more about it, because it may be something I might forget if I don't say it now. And so I do have a website, which is berlinajohnson.com, www.berlinajohnson.com. And you can see some of my work there. And also could reach out to me and, you know, to inquire about the work further, or to have any sort of dialogue. I'd absolutely welcome that. In terms of what I'm doing now, now I am, as I said, finishing up the Divine Love piece and working on the series, but I'm also thinking a lot these days about recovery and about things such as honesty, and thinking about healing in a different way. And addiction, actually, this is somewhat new, and I don't know that I've ever publicly spoken about it, but I am a compulsive overeater, and food for me has been a very contentious place within my life since I was probably a teenager, to varying degrees throughout my life. And I have known this probably consciously for maybe about 8 years or so. And, you know, whereas I've had family members who have been alcoholics and various issues with drugs, I've always said, well, I don't have those issues. And I haven't particularly. Those things kind of, I've been afraid of them, right? But I know that I have used food in very unhealthy ways, let's say, for coping and for suppressing emotion and for dealing with life has just gotten too difficult or complex, for rewarding myself, for dealing with boredom, for you name it, I've used it in a sense. And because of this preoccupation with food, I feel as though I've not sort of dealt with certain aspects of my sensitivity, my emotionality. And so I am really hell-bent on figuring that out, my relationship with food, and really wanting to be extraordinarily honest with myself about how I misuse food and why I've misused food, frankly. And I think, you know, discovering that my life had become unmanageable, so I'm working the 12 steps, that my life had become unmanageable, how I can surrender and give it up to a higher power as I understand her. And that's the second step. And so right now, to be perfectly honest, I'm working on the second step. And that for me seems to be such a fertile ground for more healing, because to me, healing and that work it's a lifelong endeavor. You know, for those who think I'm going to address the thing and then I'll be healed and it'll be done. For me, that has not been the case whatsoever. To me, I imagine it more like an onion or just having multiple layers. And as I heal and as I learn and understand various things about myself, I am just given this beautiful opportunity to delve more deeply into whatever wounds that I have as I'm being triggered in relationship, you know, with others or with myself. And so, you know, I'm working on reconciling a great many things as it relates to my emotions. And so I recently did a piece called I Am Surrendering, an abstract figurative piece in watercolor that it kind of explores just this idea of surrendering to a higher power, because surrendering has been hugely difficult. You know, I come from a childhood that was very chaotic. And so this idea of control and letting go, and I can reconnect this to sort of the depictions of myself in my earlier work, say in the 80s and the 90s and early 2000s, a lot of my self-portraits were me looking out at the viewer, because it was very important to engage the viewer, to not be an object, but rather a subjective being. And, you know, through feminisms and other discourse, kind of learning about that and that posturing in that particular way. But then as I started thinking more in terms of being introspective as it relates to my work, I began exploring things like depicting myself with my eyes closed, which is about trust, with about slightly lowering my head or exposing aspects of my neck. And part of that was because, honestly, I came to that sort of way of knowing, because I would look at Buddha, and Buddha is always shown with eyes closed, right? And so there was this notion of looking inward. And so I wish to express and explore more of those types of relationships about myself and about healing as it relates to these things. And so for me to have belief and faith that I can be restored, that I this aspect of myself can be healed by letting it go and by turning it over to my higher power as I understand her, is greatly liberating. And I don't know exactly how that will present itself, but that's part of the unfoldment, and part of the letting go is the not knowing, but being okay with that. But so I'm doing lots of journaling and writing and reading in order to release that. And what I find is, as always, using my art as a platform to explore, you know, those types of ideas. So I imagine that I will, along with the LGBT historical series, I will be doing pieces like that. Which I will at some point, I've shared a little bit on my social media platform, but which I will share in other contexts, I'm sure, because again, I believe that that is, you know, sort of what I'm to do. But thank you very much for the question. It's one that my art will always be very much connected to what I'm going through and thinking about at present moment. You know, there seems to be commonalities that stretches, you know, through time, but then there's certainly a currency that, you know, speaking to what I am thinking about at present moment. And so for right now, I think it is about having faith, you know, and a belief in our wholeness. And I think that's really what I'm doing with my work, is I'm recognizing just how perfectly imperfect I am.
I love that. Perfectly imperfect. And just what a gift that you have this beautiful relationship with art, you know, that can aid you and guide you in that healing. And then, you know, and you already said this earlier, but it really ripples out in the world, you know, because I think there's so many of us that are carrying trauma, and that manifests itself in addictions of all sorts. You know, ones that are frowned upon and ones that are kind of considered acceptable, you know? And so just to see and to be able to experience with someone else how they are processing and understanding and healing themselves is so helpful. So, you know, I want much gratitude to you for being here, but just also much gratitude for you for making your art and for having the courage to share it. It's so important. So I thank you, really.
You're welcome. And thank you very much for creating this and holding this space for us to have this very important and divinely inspired conversation today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I will make sure to put in the show notes your website for lenajohnson.com. So you can look in the show notes if you don't write it down. And I'm going to put some other things that we talked about here up in the show notes too. Some information about Audre Lorde in case you're not familiar with her work, and Faith Ringgold. We covered a lot. So I'll make sure that all that's in the show notes. And you know, I just want to thank all you listeners, as always, for joining me here. So hey, if you have feedback for me about the show, email me, liz@hometoher.com, or find me on social media. If you've got ideas about people you'd like to hear from, suggestions about topics you want me to cover, come and talk to me. I'd love to hear from you. And I thank you for being here. Oh, and as always, if you like the show, you can subscribe, you can give it a great review, you can tell your friends about it, you can do all those things. And until we meet again, take good care. Thank you for joining me. Thank you. to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.